Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. This is our last episode of 2020. It's been quite a year for all of us, and we've had some great guests that have shared some great things. And if you haven't done so, go back and listen to some of the previous episodes. This week, we're going to be going back and revisiting a conversation that we had earlier in the year with Dr. Robert Quinn. Bob has been a professor at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. He is a sought-after thought leader in the area of positive leadership. And he's going to be talking with us. And this originally was a two-part series. We've combined into one episode. But he's going to be talking about purpose-driven leadership. He's written 18 books, and he's just got a lot of great content that he shares with us in this episode. And looking forward to our conversation with Bob. So happy to have Bob Quinn joining us. And Bob, I guess, first off, can you give us just a little bit of your story, your personal story, and kind of how you've gotten to where you are today?
Well, I grew up on the East Coast in a small town. Went to university. I became very interested in the notion of change. That one word was a fanatic obsession of mine. So I studied change, and then I got my PhD, and I did research on change. I did consulting on change. I taught change. And that word became the planet around which I have orbited most of my life.
Well, we're in a very unusual time in our history, and everybody's kind of in the same boat, and a lot of people are sitting at home and working at home and doing everything at home right now, and there's a lot of stress and anxiety, and people are trying to stay positive, but it's pretty challenging in this time. Talk a little bit about the importance of staying positive, and just what are some things that people can be doing as far as if they're new leaders or up-and-coming leaders, that they can stay in a positive mindset.
It's interesting, the notion of crisis. It naturally creates anxiety. And yet we have various traditions that told us for a long time that crisis is also opportunity. But it's very hard to see or believe that when you're in the middle of one. But I think it is absolutely opportunity. And it's a personal opportunity, and it's a collective opportunity. We finished a book a few months ago. It was published, and we did interviews a couple of years ago with CEOs of purpose-driven companies. These are value-driven, highly, highly successful companies. It was amazing how many of those leaders traced their key development back to the year 2008. Mm. Now, 2008 was the Great Recession, and almost every business leader went into crisis. And many of them came out the way they went in. But all of these people came out very differently than the way they went in. And it's in crisis that we're forced to, because we don't know what to do, we're forced to get out of our ego and ask questions about who am I, what's my identity, what's my destiny, what's my purpose. And that's the beginning of a profound life change. If someone negotiates that effectively, they develop the capacity to help other people move through uncertainty, crisis, so forth. They become leaders. A manager is not a leader. Holding a position, you can be CEO of a company, that doesn't make you a leader. Holding a position is not being a leader. A leader is a person of influence, and they're not meeting the criteria of leadership until someone's willingly following them. And so this is a time of great, great opportunity for people trapped at home to do work they normally don't want to do and figure out who they are, what their greatest strengths are, what their mission is, what their contribution is, and then take that to the world. And you will see many, many people do that in coming months. But the more we do that, the more it changes things. And suddenly we go from anxiety and fear to purpose and confidence. And we function differently biologically. It's a huge difference.
So any personal stories that you could share as far as around kind of finding that purpose and people that you've worked with, and that you've done a lot of consulting with executives as well as other leaders?
Sure. I think that it's helpful to start probably at the personal level. You know, I've written a lot about what I call the fundamental state of leadership. It's normal for you and I to be comfort-centered. It's normal for us to be externally directed, worried about what other people think, to be self-focused, and to be internally closed. That's a natural, normal state that I gravitate to, and so does everyone else. But it's possible to transform ourselves in real time. And I've written a lot about four questions that'll do that. The first question is, what result do I want to create? The moment I ask that question and answer it, now answering it's the hard part, we usually don't know what result we want to create. And we hear the question and think, oh, I ask that all the time. I'm a busy, productive person. No, we don't. Most of the time, you and I are asking the question, what do I want? Now, there's a big difference between what I want and what result do I want to create. Because what I want is to be comfortable. I don't want to be in uncertainty. I don't want to be in a situation where I'm embarrassed because I don't meet your expectations. So I want to be comfortable. I want this problem, whatever it is, to go away. When I ask the question, what result do I want to create, it instantaneously changes sociology. Sociology says people are path dependent. They're determined by their past. Now, you only need to spend a few minutes to say that's an impeccable assumption. It's absolutely true. The past determines the future. But if we ask the question, when does the future determine the present? I meant the past determines the present. When does the future determine the present? That's an interesting question. Seems like a heretical question. But the moment you and I know the answer to the question, what result do I want to create, suddenly the future is determining the present. Everything changes. The second question is, am I internally directed? Because all of us are hypocrites. You know, I have a set of values way up here and they look like this. Then I have behaviors down here and they look like this. And there are these big gaps. And the way I handle those is I bury them. Because they stink. I don't want to smell them. And we go through life like that. But the moment you take the top off that garbage can and you take a deep breath and smell that hypocrisy, it's such a terrible stench that you're immediately motivated to close one of those gaps. And when you close one of those gaps, you suddenly feel good about yourself. And the moment you feel good about yourself, you look at others and you see potential in them you didn't see before because you're realizing potential in you that wasn't being realized. The third question is, am I other focused? Do I understand the deepest needs and interests of the other people in the equation? Are they just objects like economic theory says they are? Or are they human beings with needs and interests? And do I understand those and am I oriented to those? The moment I am, I'm in the state of empathy. My boundaries are open. You and I become one. When you and I become one, we move from debate to dialogue. You share what you really feel. I share what I really feel. Learning accelerates. And then the fourth question is, am I externally open? Am I willing to be an equal with you in the process of learning and co-creating a mutual future? Now, the moment I answer those questions, I instantaneously shift my state of being. Suddenly, I'm functioning at a very different level. And I have influence, moral influence, that I didn't have before. It's not about authority. It's about influence without authority. Managers have authority, and they tell people what to do. Leaders transcend authority. They still have the authority, but that's not what they use. They use influence, and they inspire and move people into new places. Most organizations are dying because they have managers they call leaders, but they're not really leaders, right? And so the fundamental state of leadership always puts you in a new place. You can see where the system's going and what we need to do to get there.
What are some exercises that people can be doing during this time you mentioned as far as discovering kind of your purpose? Anything that's helpful? It's hard work if you've ever sat down with a blank sheet of paper and tried to come up with kind of your overall purpose, but anything that you've found that's been helpful and would be helpful?
Yes, there's many things we can do. One exercise is to list the 10 best things that ever happened to you and the 10 worst things that ever happened to you. And then ask the question, what has life prepared me to do that no one else can do? Now, that's really an interesting exercise, because if you list the 10 best, that feels really good. But you get halfway through the second list and you're depressed, right? All these terrible things that happened to you. But then you ask that magical question, what has life prepared me to do? No, suddenly, the 10 terrible things are transformed. I've now had 20 significant life experiences that have shaped me. And I therefore have capacity that's unique. So what's my contribution? What are my strengths? What can I give away? And who do I want to give them away to? Because a purpose is not ego-based. A purpose is contribution-based, right? And so, how do I want to spend my life here? And how can I clarify that purpose so that every decision I make is aligned with the purpose? Now, the moment you go there, you go to a different life. You live differently than the conventional person. You can list your successes. You know, what have been your successes in life? And what have those successes had in common? Were you acting individually or collectively? Were you in this role or that role? There's a fingerprint there. And what is that fingerprint, if you can distill it from across those experiences, what does that tell you about what you're like at your best? And how does that fit into your purpose? Now, the process of finding purpose. I have a friend, Nick Craig, who's done 15,000 people, helping them find their purpose. And he says his purpose is to wake you up and bring you home. And I really like that. The moment you find what your purpose really is, it's as if you've woken up. You can now see things you couldn't see 5 minutes ago. And it's like coming home. It's like someplace you're incredibly comfortable. This is who I really am. Most people never have that experience. But once you have it, everything changes. So if a coronavirus hits and all of a sudden you're locked into your house, you can be bored to death or you can be asking, what's my life purpose? And what can I do with this house today? It's going to further that purpose. Robert Fritz said, when you know the answer to the question, what result am I going to create? If you feel good, you pursue your purpose. If you feel bad, you pursue your purpose. That is, once you have a purpose, you're constantly pursuing it. And it doesn't matter your emotional state, because as you pursue it, your emotional state is going to turn positive. Mm. And that's a very, very powerful notion. And it's at the very heart of leadership. Leadership is not about knowledge and skills. The entire industry, bookshelves full of leadership books, and all about, here's the knowledge and skills you need to be like Jack Welch. And the only problem is you're not Jack Welch. That's not who you are. And if you pretend to be Jack Welch, you're going to be inauthentic, and you're not going to have that influence. Leadership is about influence. If you pursue your purpose, you'll develop knowledge and skills you need to be who you are. that's way, way far away from all those leadership books we read. Mm-hmm.
I know I've heard you say that there's a danger of trying to be an expert on everything. Talk a little bit about that. I think as people are in new leadership roles, sometimes you want to be that subject matter expert on everything and have the answer to everything. Talk a little bit about that.
There's a reason for that. That is, from the time we were born, we knew when you were 3 years old, you knew it was better to be on top of a hierarchy than on the bottom. And he said, I'll be the father, I'll be the general, whatever game you were playing, right? And the thing that gets us there is knowledge, expertise. We go to school to gather knowledge. If we pass the test, we graduate. If we have the right credentials, we get the job. And the first day in an MBA program, first 5 minutes, you immediately discover that everything's about looking smart. So you spend the next 2 years pretending you know everything. And it's an enormously insecure situation. And then a terrible thing happens. You get a job in a big corporation. And they worship the same God, the God of knowing. Not the God of learning, the God of knowing. And you pretend to know everything. And that's where all your expertise, that's where all your authority comes from, all your power, all your promotions. I was interviewing a CEO who was a brilliant financial mind. So he went up the financial silo in record time, and he became CEO of a very large company. He was there 11 years. The last 10 years were spectacular. First year was a disaster. He was almost fired. And the reason he was almost fired is he used his authority, told people what to do, and nothing happened. It's a violation of that theory he's learned so well. But in big organizations, you tell people what to do and they nod their head, go back to their desk, and nothing happens. And it was very difficult for him. And then one day, two people said to him, if there's a vision in this company, we don't know what it is. And he was furious with them. They were suggesting he was the problem. And then the next day, he was talking to Wall Street analysts. And the analyst said, I don't see any vision in this company. Now that was devastating. He was just destroyed. And he didn't believe in vision. He didn't believe in people, purpose, or culture. He believed in economics and power and authority. And he went through a crisis. He came to a new view of reality, a much fuller view. And the next 10 years were spectacular. It was a night and day change. Now, at the end of the interview, he said, I can look at my problems from year one, and I can boil them down to one single word. The word was expert. I needed to be the expert. That's what it means to be a CEO. He said, when I overcame that, I began to lead. That's a very important notion, because in this society, we worship knowledge. We don't worship learning. We worship knowledge. And that leads us into some very big traps, especially for people of authority, people in hierarchies. And so we just keep, we act on what we know, and we keep reproducing the past, and the organization goes into slow death. And no one knows what to do about it. They just keep reenacting the past.
Talk a little bit about developing a positive organization. You know, a lot of people, when they're first starting out in leadership, they don't have the influence as far as to affect the whole organization. They're maybe given a small group of people that they're leading to start out with. How can somebody impact a group of people, maybe a handful of people, to make it more positive? And what are some things that you found that's helpful?
Yeah. In the year 2000, Kim Cameron and Jane Dutton and I founded the field of positive organization scholarship. And it was based on the question, what do people, groups, and organizations look like at their very best? Now, that was revolutionary. So for the last 20 years, we've been inundated with studies in that new field, and we've learned an enormous amount about moving from conventional practices to moving to excellence. Now, I give talks all over the world. The single most frequent question that I'm asked is, I really like these ideas of positive leadership and building a positive culture and an excellent company. I just love them, but I'm trapped. You see, I'm just a nobody at the bottom of this hierarchy. I'm a teacher in a school and the principal doesn't listen to me. You know, or I work, you know, I'm in the military. No one listens to you in the military. I'm in fill in the blank. That is, everywhere I go, that question is asked, and it's a self-disempowering question. It's an honest question. That's what they feel, is that question. It's a driving question. But it's a self-disempowering question because they're absolutely certain. They're not, there's no doubt. They're absolutely certain that they're powerless. Right? That's the starting point. So that means you are. and yet, there are exceptions to the rule. We find people who are in the same role, same low position, in the same company, and they're not without influence. Now, if that's true, if there's 100 people in your role in your company, and one of them has power, has influence, that's an exception, and you're going to reject it because, oh, that's because she has blonde hair, whatever it is. But that exception is the path to excellence. And that exception is crucial because if we can learn from excellence, we can find the way there. Now, let me come out of the abstract and just give you a very concrete example. I knew a woman who went to work in a big company, and in the higher echelons of that company, there was not a single woman. It was all men. The customer base was more than 50% women. And the women who did work there at the lower echelons were deeply troubled by their daily experiences. And so they asked if she could help. So they gathered data showing what it was like, what the customer base was like, the kinds of decisions that got made that weren't good decisions because of it, what it was like statistically to be a woman in that company. And they took it to a person at the second echelon, who was very powerful, and they presented, and he was very respectful. You know, oh, I understand these things. Thank you very much. Of course, nothing happened. Now, every woman in that group was devastated, and they all came to the same conclusion. They were powerless, and there was nothing they could do. The same conclusion that millions of others make every day. This woman didn't come to that conclusion. She said, oh, we're just getting started. What she did next is very interesting. She interviewed every woman in the company. She asked them to share their most poignant experience at work, their greatest pain, their greatest success and joy. And she consolidated all of that in her mind and heart. And then she prepared to go back to the same person with the same set of slides, but this time with the stories. And she was just about to go when she decided to take one more step. She went to the one woman who told the most devastating story. And she said, I want you to come with me and tell the story. Oh, I couldn't do that. I want you to come with me and tell the story. This is how we're going to change the organization. So she dragged the woman with her. They met with the same person. And this time she took them, that person, through story after story after story. So here's the statistic and here's the story. What do you think about that? She engaged them. What do you think about this story? What do you think about these feelings? Then she had this woman stand up and tell her story. The man said, would you two go with me and meet with the CEO? Which they did. And dramatic changes happened in that company. Now that's a profoundly important story. here's a powerless woman, just like all the other women, except she's not powerless. She's an agent of change. She has influence. Now, if she can do that, you and I can do it. And we say, no, we can't. We don't know how to do that. That's right. What she did was outside the norms. Right? What she did was she was learning in real time how to change that company because she was living in purpose. That's what leaders are. And the moment we say, yeah, but I'm at the bottom, how can I possibly do anything? We're dead. That's the wrong question. The right question is, what result do I want to create? If I want this company to change, if I want my boss to change, now how do I effectively do that? My first thoughts are always ineffective thoughts. I've got to do some hard work to make it happen.
I heard you talk about a study that you did about a school district. I think it was in Ohio where mm-hmm. you went and studied the top 1% of teachers or group. Talk a little bit about that, kind of the impact that they had and what you saw and observed and people that made a difference.
If you measure performance and you select the top 1% of any large group, you're going to find some very interesting people. I knew before I ever left Ann Arbor to go to Ohio. Now, what we had access to was the top 1% of all the teachers in Ohio by objective measure. I knew before I ever went there, because these were school teachers who walk on water, right? You send your kid to fourth grade. They come home in June doing seventh grade work. They advance 3 years in 1 year. That's impossible, right? So these are teachers who do miracles. And it's not just your kid, it's every kid in the room. So this is something that can't exist. This is something that can't be real. Now, I knew before I left Ann Arbor, these were not school teachers. What were they? They were transformational leaders. Now, if you called them that, they'd have a heart attack. But that's what they were. Now, what did we find? We found people who didn't have jobs. They didn't have careers. They had callings. They were there for a very high purpose, and it wasn't about them. It was about the students. They didn't teach math or history or English. Math or history or English was an excuse to be in relationship with the students. The objective was not to pass a test. The objective was to acquire the love of learning. Because when my student acquires the love of learning, they're empowered for the rest of their lives. And so I'm not here to do what the other teachers are here to do, that is to take content and put it in the brain and give a test to see if it's memorized. I'm here to transform the lives of these students. Those interviews were spectacular in terms of inspiration. Every single interview was inspiring. Why? Because they're not operating from knowledge and authority of the role of school teacher. They're operating from the notion of the future and of you realizing your potential, and they know how to do that. So when they talk to someone like me, I'm sitting there with my mouth open. That was an incredibly educational study. Now, I want to say again, that study's not about school teachers. That's about whoever you are, wherever you are, in terms of influence. It's about leadership. But it's not the way we normally think about leadership.
You've written 18 books in your career. And you've had a lot of, and one of the titles, and I haven't read this one. I've read the first book that I read of yours was Deep Change, and I loaned it out to somebody, and I tried to find it the other day, and it hasn't come back. So I need to write. Somebody told me they did this with their library, wrote stolen from the library of, and then put your name so you get it back. But anyway, so I ordered another copy. But there's a title that that I was reading, Building the Bridge as You Walk on It. And I was thinking, I haven't read the book, but that's an interesting title. And it seems like kind of where we are right now is kind of building the bridge as we walk on it, not sure what the future is. I don't know if there's, you know, some relevance to where we are today with that book, but I know you wrote it a number of years ago.
Well, I think one of the interesting things about that book is where the title came from. I was at a small company that was a very successful company. And I was there with a doctoral student, so the doctoral student could write a case study about this company. And so we went to the first meeting with the CEO, who I knew very well. And the doctoral student, in essence, said, how did you become such a great company? And this CEO said, well, you know, we had this challenge and we worked really, really hard and put this strategy in place and we were smart. And with that hard work, we became the great company you see today. And I leaned forward and said, that's a lie. And the CEO looked like I'd slapped him in the face. And I said, you know, you started out, you had this purpose, you had this strategy. Strategy A didn't work. Everything you did got worse. So you went to strategy B. That made it still worse. That led you to this insight. You had strategy C. And then all of a sudden this took off, and over here this took off, and you brought B over to this thing, and then this happened. And he got a huge smile on his face. And he looked at me and he said, and at the doctoral student, and he said, yeah, the truth is we built the bridge as we walked on it. Hmm. Now, that is such an interesting story. Why did he tell the first story to the doctoral student? Because that's the story we're all expected to tell. If you're a success, how did you get there? I was smart and I worked hard. That's the story that we're expected right to tell. That creates a linear image that simply isn't true. The fact is that if you're going to build an organization, you're walking in deep uncertainty all the time. You don't know what you're doing, and you're learning as you go. You're building the bridge as you walk on it. But you can't say that because you have to pretend to be smart. And so the question is, how do I learn in uncertainty? And the answer is what we said. You clarify constantly what the highest purpose is, and then you move one foot forward into the dark, and then another one. And you ask yourself, what did I just learn? And you make adjustments and you take another step. That is not what the textbooks say. Now think about this pandemic that we're in. We are and will be in total uncertainty. The entire economy will be turned upside down. People will go into panic. They'll be full of anxiety. They'll go into fight or flight and it'll be very unproductive. And a few people will say, no problem. What result do I want to create? What's my highest purpose here? And they'll take one step into the darkness and then another, and they'll keep adjusting as they try to find that purpose. And other people will join them, and great things will happen. Right next to them, there'll be disaster on their right, disaster on their left. Hmm. But and that's what building the bridge as we walk on it is all about. And people that write leadership books don't want to ever understand or say that. And managers, and it's a good reason, you won't sell any books because managers don't want to hear that. Right?
Right.
Give me the silver bullet, the sure one thing I can do and I'll be absolutely successful the rest of my life. Tell me what I need to know, not how to learn.
That's great. That's great advice. Yeah, I heard one executive recently said that kind of their whole thing for their company is to have a 30-day plan, and uh, you you plan out 30 days, this is what we're going to do, and you adjust. And then at the end of that 30 days, you figure out the next 30 days and try to figure out any other thoughts around that. And I'm sure you've gotten calls from executives that are concerned and trying to figure things out. What are some of the things that you're telling them?
Having that 30-day plan is perfectly okay with me. My question to those same executives is, what's your highest purpose? And they never know. And they always give some, you know, some of them say profit, some of them say survival, some of them say something more acceptable. But they don't know because they've never done the work. And the question is, what is the highest purpose of this company? And that's not profit. That's a survival answer. What is the contribution? What is it that ignites every single person in this company? They never know, because they never do that work. I'm being very strong, saying never, of course, the exceptions, but the majority don't. They don't even understand the question. But the moment that I start to become a purpose-driven leader, I first envision a totally committed workforce. Most people don't. They envision people who have to be controlled because they don't want to work. That's the whole notion of hierarchical theory and economic theory. It's the principal-agent problem. But I'm going to a new place. My new place is I'm going to envision totally engaged people. If I envision that, then how do I discover, not know, how do I discover the purpose of this organization? And the answer is I do a ton of listening and hold a ton of dialogues until it starts to crystallize for me what the highest collective purpose really is. It's almost never known or stated because no one ever does that work. If I discover it, then the question is, how do I bring it into reality? And the answer is I make it the arbiter of every decision. I was visiting a company, and bunch of us were sitting around the table, and this mid-level woman said, I just came out of a meeting with my boss, and he said, we're going to do X. And she said, we are not. We're not going to do that. Now, every head snapped at that table when they heard that. And then she explained, she said, he wanted to do this. I told him that's not our purpose. The highest purpose of this company is this, and we can't do that. My boss's response was, oh, yeah, you're right. Now, at that moment, the CEO leaned in. He was sitting next to me, and he said, see what I mean? When the purpose is the arbiter of every decision, that means every person's empowered. The entire system is learning and contributing, and everybody's going in the right place. Well, that's a profoundly powerful image. Very few companies, teams, organizations, units, groups ever benefit from that because they don't have a leader that does that.
So that whole idea of being transparent with those that you're leading, for that CEO to admit, yeah, I forgot what was obvious to somebody sitting next to me at a different level. They still had that in mind, but I forgot it. Is that part of what you've seen kind of overall with the CEOs that you worked with, the ability to take from somebody who's not their boss, somebody that's managing up, to say, hey, you're missing something that's really important?
Yeah, I think when a person grows from manager to leader, they suddenly become an integration of contrasting virtues. They're incredibly strong and very humble. They're tough and full of love. They're stable and willing to change. They're engaged but willing to be reflective, right? They have enormous behavioral complexity because they can integrate values that are normally contrasting values. Most of us become single variable maximizers, or what Bateson called schismogenic thinkers. The moment we latch on to a purpose, any purpose, And then we pick a goal. The goal is profit. Then we become schismogenic, cut away all the other things. And initially, we start to succeed. And then we cross a tipping point. And then everything starts to go wrong, and we apply the strategy with greater intensity, causing greater failure. And we go into a vicious cycle. And this happens to every one of us with regularity in life, because we can't see the whole ecology of value and virtue. We don't have the ability to enlarge and learn in real time. But when we become purpose-driven, when we start living from contributive goals instead of ego goals, all of that changes. Our ability to do those things increases. And so when you listen to those purpose-driven CEOs, almost everyone will tell you their version of the expert story. You know, I could reduce all my problems to one word, expert. Now, that was his story. But everyone has a version of that story, of discovering they're not the center of the world, and that you and I learning together is a much more powerful system than me telling you what to do. Now, there's always a place for hierarchy. There's a need for hierarchy. But if that's all you see, you are blind. And you're eventually going to get into trouble.
Really good. You told a story, and this kind of applies back to it, about your daughter having an experience where it was a negative experience, but something positive came out of it. And could you tell that story? I love that story. And
it's at the heart of that whole purpose argument. She was getting older. She was single. She was living in Washington, D.C. And she was getting very discouraged because she now wanted to be married. But her conclusion was the only men left on the earth that were her age were pigs. You know, there were just nobody left. And then all of a sudden, Prince Charming showed up, and she was so excited. And after a few months, the phone rang, and she's talking to my wife, and I could tell what the conversation was. This guy just dumped her, and she's devastated and angry. And you know, she was our firstborn child, and most firstborn children share a common need. If they're miserable, they want you to be miserable too. And so she said, "I'm coming home this weekend." I thought, "Oh no." And her mother said, "You're the father, you go to the airport." I pick her up, she gets in the car. She doesn't say, "Hello, how are you?" She says, "That no good, dirty, da 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 da." And 5 minutes later, takes a breath, and I say, "Are you problem solving or purpose finding?" She didn't even hear me. Second time, third time. You know, by the time we get to the driveway, she does it a fourth or fifth time. And I say, "Are you problem solving or purpose finding?" And she looks at me and she says, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, I wrote that letter to your brother about the difference between problem solving and purpose finding. And I sent you a copy." She said, "This is the real world." I said, "Well, I think it applies to the real world." And so by now we're in the house, and I pull out a sheet of paper, and it says Robert Quinn Life Statement. And she rips it out of my hand. She looks at it, and then she slows down. She starts reading. She looks up, and she said, "When you feel bad, you read this?" And I said, "No, when I feel bad, I rewrite it. It's been rewritten hundreds of times." She looks at it again. She said, "Do you think I could write one of these?" And I said, "I'm sure you can." And that's when the first miracle happened. She disappeared into the bedroom, and for a day and a half, she worked on that document. And the miracle was I did not have to suffer. She got on the plane. She went back to D.C. And 3 days later, an email came, and she said, "He called me." And so I wrote him this letter. I read the letter. And the letter was incredibly authentic and vulnerable. "Here's how I felt when I met you. Here's how I felt in the middle. Here's how I felt when you dumped me." And it was astoundingly transparent. And then she wrote, "But my roommate said, you can't give this to him." Now that's very, very traditional wisdom. You can't give this to him. Now, there's a good reason. The reason is this letter is telling the truth. You can't tell the truth to some guy who's dumped you. Marketing is, dating is a marketplace. Dating is business, right? You have to be tough. You have to deceive people. And she said, what my roommates didn't understand is that what he thought didn't matter. Now, wait a minute. 3 days ago, what he thought caused her life to disintegrate. Now she's saying what he thinks doesn't matter. What in the world has happened here? She's clarified her purpose. She's internally directed. She's more caring than she's ever been. And she's willing to learn. She's incredibly strong. So she can tell the truth because she's centered and it's the truth. So what he thinks doesn't matter. And her roommates can't comprehend that because they're in transactional theory, the theory of business. Well, the interesting thing is a short time later, she was promoted for the first time, then promoted again. Why in the world is she promoted? This is a story about dating. And the answer is because she's now a leader. And that organization needed leadership. She's coming to work. She's got the same dresses on, has the same face, talks the same language, but she's not the same person. So that's a really important story because it's about every one of us. It's about who we are and it's about our potential.
Yeah, I love that story. That's because I think we can all relate. We've been in those situations. You've written 18 books, and I know I've asked other authors this, you know, pick the top, and I wouldn't say your top three favorites, but maybe your top three that you think would be most relative to today and kind of what people are experiencing, any that you think they should start with, and then they can finish the rest of the 18 as they go along.
Well, I guess I'd say that in today's situation, in the middle of this pandemic, that there are some that really are appropriate. And the first one, I think, is the one you read, Deep Change, which basically helps us understand that there's incremental learning, there's transformational learning, and you and I can engage in transformational learning, and here's how to do that. The second, I think, is a book called Lift, The Fundamental State of Leadership. It talks about how you can ask those four questions, and it buttresses everything with research to show why it's legitimate. But as a basic, simple model there, and in this pandemic, everybody can benefit from applying that model. And I think the third one I would suggest is the one that was just published. It's called The Economics of Higher Purpose, How to Create a Purpose-Driven Organization. And even if you're not running an organization, it's a book that starts with that story about my daughter and looks at personal purpose, the research on personal purpose, the impacts of personal purpose, and then takes that to the organization. And it exposes, we call them 8 counterintuitive steps. They're simple steps, but they're outside normal management thought. They're outside the ego. And they're incredibly powerful, and they apply to a marriage, to any relationship. So I think Deep Change, Lift, and The Economics of Higher Purpose. If you live through those three, I think you'd have a very powerful dose of what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, if you also check out your TED Talks and your Google Talk, love those. And those are great to view. Outside of work, Bob, what do you do to recharge?
I love to recharge by doing work. That is, I believe that writing, because I spent a lot of time in organizations, helping people think about what their challenges are. But I love to come back and write about those experiences around my purpose. That's very recharging. In terms of recreation, I love to play golf. It's not a competitive golf. It's about being totally focused. That's what happens to me on the golf course. And I can't blame someone else for throwing me a bad pass. And it's an enormous mental discipline. And it renews me to have that focus. There are personal things I do. I keep a gratitude journal. It has enormous impact on my daily renewal. Can't say enough about that. And then I spend a lot of time with the family trying to engage in really meaningful experiences with them. And when that works, that's wonderful. It's hard work, but when it works, it's wonderful.
That's great. So if somebody would want to learn more about you and your work, what's the best way for them to find that information?
There's two. I think they can read the normal stuff, the books we just talked about so far. But 2 years ago, we did something that some people have found to be very useful. At the University of Michigan, if you go to the executive education website, there's a program called Becoming Who You Really Are. And the way it works is I made 100 videos, 3 minutes each. And if you sign up for the course, every day you get a 3 minute video. And then there are two questions. Question one is, listening to that story, because every video is a story, what principle do you see in it? Not what did Quinn say, but what do you see in it? Given the principle you've identified, what can you do today to better live that principle? Now, if you go through with a cohort, which most people do, then on Friday you answer another question, and that is, of the 5 experiments I ran this week, which one was most powerful? And you write a 1-paragraph description of that, and then that gets shared with everybody else in your cohort. What happens over the 100 days is a new perspective becomes available. If you go through with people in your own team or organization, a second level of payoff occurs. You begin to create a common set of images. One woman wrote, said, I was in a meeting with my boss. We were with a very angry customer. It was going really bad when I suddenly blurted out, we have to stop and wash the flag. Now, that was from a story I told. The boss immediately understood that, and they changed their strategy instantaneously, and it came out very, very well. And she said, that's when I realized what it meant to be creating a culture together, that going through those stories, creating those common images, is not only leadership development, it's organization development. And so, for either individuals or people who are trying to get groups of people to move forward, that's a very painless but very mind-stretching experience, and we've had lots of positive feedback about it. So that might be something that people would be interested in as well.
Sure. And for your blog and other writings, it's roberteQuinn.com. Is that the best
website? Or you can type in all one word, thepositiveorganization.wordpress.com. It'll come up there as well.
Great. Any parting advice that you'd give a leader?
Well, I'm glad you asked that as a way to close. I think that we're all having a common experience right now. It's the biggest event since World War II. And every day I'm in some Zoom meeting having some conversation, a lot like this one usually. And the last 2 days, I've had 2 people who are in education. They said, I've been talking to teachers and they're crying when I talk to them. Well, I don't think that's just about teachers. I think that people are in great anxiety. And it's very understandable. But what we've just talked about is a way to turn the anxiety into positive energy that makes you better as an individual and makes other people better, makes the world better. So I think our conversation today is very, very timely. And my advice would be, if you're feeling a lot of uncertainty and a lot of pain, you know, listen to this podcast one more time. Read some of that material and clarify that purpose. Start moving. Everything will start getting better. You know, if you have a life trauma like this one, but a more specific one at a different time, it distorts your life narrative. And what happens is you shut down. You usually end up on a psychologist's couch and you're depressed. There are hundreds of therapies that psychologists use, but the common denominator is clarification of purpose and values. The moment you clarify your purpose and values, you get off the couch, you're empowered. And so my final piece of advice, I guess, would be understand those four questions I talked about. Ask them rigorously of yourself. It's hard work to answer those questions. Get them answered, and then do what comes to you, because what comes to you will be very, very positive.
Really good stuff. I'm going to go back and listen to this podcast a couple of times myself. It's good information. No, I'm always encouraged when I listen to you. You've got a great way of communicating, and definitely appreciate just all that you've shared today, and looking forward to reading your next book, and definitely wish you continued success in your writing and speaking and influencing.
Thank you. Thank you so much for letting me do this.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.